infiltration rate would look like. They keep saying 90, don't they? Everything I read says 60, so. Okay, so uremic syndrome, increased nitrogen waste in the blood. You get the fluid and electrolyte disturbances. Fluid what? Fluid overload. And usually your electrolytes are going high because you're not getting rid of the stuff. Treatment can be conservative or aggressive. Now, it's usually more conservative when it's renal insufficiency. When it's renal failure, you got to do something, or else the patient's going to die. You got to do something. All right, so conservative would be medications. They might use diuretics to get rid of excess fluid. Diet, what diet would it be? Low sodium, low potassium, just to keep these levels as low as we can. Low protein sometimes, they watch their protein. And why a fluid restriction? Because you don't want them taking up, you don't want them overloading. So usually you'll see a fluid restriction on these people. So what a fluid restriction means is they just can't have a drink, a soda every time they feel like it. You might limit it to 1,200 mLs a day. So they just have to watch when they drink and keep track of it. And these patients would definitely be on intake and output because you would need to keep track of how much they're drinking. How much is in usually a cup? 240 mLs, a basic size cup. And most of the milk cartons and things like that. But if your patients are on a fluid restriction, you should be measuring, looking at the volume of what they're drinking. They shouldn't have free access to the water pitcher, right? Because then you can't keep track of how much they're drinking. Because they're not putting out as much urine. And you don't want them to go into a fluid overload status. Now, more aggressive is renal replacement therapies. We're replacing the function of the kidney. So what we see most of the time is dialysis. And there's two types, peritoneal and hemodialysis. So I'm going to talk about each one of those. Or we can go to organ transplantation. Now, how do you think we get to organ transplantation? Patient has to get put on what? Transplant list, right? So what do we have to wait for? I'm just going to sit down. My legs bother me a little bit. What do we have to... There has to be a tissue match. There has to be an organ available. So do you think people wait years and years for this? I mean, it's not like we can just say, I need an organ transplant, and you're going to get it. You get put on an organ transplant list, and you have to wait until a suitable donor is available. But also, you have to fit the criteria to get the organ transplant, too. Okay? So, Ed, you want to say something about that?
I was going to mention that you have to meet the criteria and keep up. Like, they have you, you have to not, you know, I have a friend who... He had to quit smoking. They took him off the transplant list because he didn't stop smoking. Now he stopped smoking, so they put him back on. He's been stopped.
Yeah, what about someone who's an uncontrolled diabetic who doesn't take care of their blood sugars? I mean, they're not going to give you a new kidney so that you can harm that one. The same thing with liver transplants. I mean, what's the main reason that someone needs a liver transplant? Probably alcoholism that causes cirrhosis of the liver. So am I going to give you a liver transplant if you're not going to stop drinking alcohol? I mean, what's the point? Or you're just going to destroy that liver. So you do have to meet the criteria and be proactive and willing to make lifestyle changes in order to support having a fresh start, so to say. Nick, did you have your own hand up?
Hepatitis
could cause enough liver damage to need a transplant. It depends. It possibly could. All right, so dialysis. There's two different types. First one is peritoneal. Now, peritoneal is what? Is that your kidney?
No.
Where's your peritoneal cavity? Your abdomen, right? So basically, it's an indirect method of cleansing the blood of waste products through the process of osmosis and diffusion, which is, I mean, basically what's happened with hemodialysis too. But what happens with peritoneal dialysis is they're going to implant a catheter into your peritoneal cavity, okay? And it's going to get hooked up to a bag of fluid that will instill into the peritoneal cavity, and you let it sit there for a while, you know, maybe like an hour, a couple hours. And then you drain it back out. And this fluid has the ability to pull the waste products from the bloodstream into the fluid and then back out of the body. So it's interesting, I've run peritoneal dialysis, runs on patients before. It goes in as a clear fluid and comes out looking like urine. Interesting. Now, it's a more gentler way of doing dialysis, but does it seem a little bit confining? Mm-hmm. Like you're hooked up, this catheter is hooked up to a bag and it cycles, you know, you might have to have 4, 5, 6 cycles done. And each cycle takes an hour. So you would be kind of home-ridden, right, while these things are happening. So when do you think people do this?
At night.
They do it at night. So peritoneal dialysis is an option, and you can do it at home.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful. You have to watch for infection. You have to treat this very carefully because you wouldn't want bacteria going into your peritoneal cavity. So this would be done under almost like a sterile technique. So who's ever doing it with you? And they have a machine that cycles the fluid. So it instills the fluid, then drains it out. And then instills the fluid and drains it out. Okay, and you have this big drainage bag that you would be hooked up to during the night. You could cap this catheter off during the day. How many of you have seen a PEG tube? Now the PEG tube kind of looks like what a peritoneal dialysis catheter would look like. You could clamp it off and walk around during the day and not be hooked up to the tubing and the machine. Okay? One method of dialysis, but again, it would have to be done every single day for the rest of your life. Okay? Every single day. All right, so hemodialysis, you're going to be hooked up to a machine that does this process that utilizes osmosis diffusion and ultrafiltration through a vascular graft. So it's right into your bloodstream. So it's going to usually go through like your vena cava. They'll implant a catheter into your vena cava. So usually you'll see it in the superior vena cava. But that's temporary. It's like a central line. Can you leave something in your superior vena cava forever, walk around in it? So very high risk of what? Infection. So it's a temporary blood dialysis access port. But what they'll do over time is implant a graft into the arm. Has anyone seen one yet? Okay, and they'll go to surgery and they'll do what we call an AV fistula. Arterial venous fistula. And it's under the skin and almost looks like a big chunky vein or vessel. And if you touch it, what happened when you touched it?
My dad, it feels like a thrill.
It feels like a thrill. You feel like a purring almost.
Yeah,
and if you were to put your stethoscope over it, you'd hear what we call a bruit. That means the graft is patent and functioning properly. And when they do the dialysis, they access that with needles. So they get the venous port, the venous system, and the arterial system. Now, nurses are trained specifically to do this. This wouldn't be something that you as a new graduate nurse would go out doing on patients. But you could go into the specialty of working with dialysis. And all you do is come in with this machine and access the graft and sit with the patient. Now, usually dialysis is 3 times a week. It would be a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule, or a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday schedule. And usually 3 hours of blood filtration. And you see a big drop, they'll do a BUN and creatinine before and after. What else do you think? What do you think also they're taking off with dialysis? Fluid. You should weigh your patients before dialysis and after. They can drop like 2 pounds during dialysis. Wouldn't you love it? 2 pounds because of the fluid they're taking off. They can take a liter of fluid off during dialysis. Okay? Now thinking about the fact that we just said, now this peritoneal dialysis is more gentle. This hemodialysis, we're actually doing blood, we've got diffusion, osmosis, we got fluid gradients going on, fluid shifts, we're taking a liter of fluid off in 3 hours. What do you think can happen?
Constipation.
What?
Constipation.
Not constipation. Fluid shifts, fluid volume shifts. Drop in blood pressure, okay? If I take a liter of fluid off you quickly, it could drop your blood pressure. So sometimes that's what you see happen during hemodialysis is patients drop their blood pressure. So some patients don't tolerate hemodialysis. If they have a very low blood pressure to begin with, they sometimes don't tolerate it, okay? So sometimes they have to give blood during dialysis just to sometimes help with their blood pressure, okay?
These patients are not producing any urine.
Not necessarily.
I was just thinking,
are we looking necessarily solely at amount of urine they put out? What are we looking at? glomerular filtration rate. Some people can be in end-stage renal disease and still urinate a little bit. Maybe 100 mLs a day.
But they're definitely in danger of fluid overload.
Oh, definitely. Daily. Let me tell you, I've seen patients miss a dialysis treatment and they come in and full-blown pulmonary edema. Okay, absolutely. They need this dialysis or they will go into fluid overload. Absolutely. You don't skip these treatments once you start them. And then this is another rest of your life situation, dialysis. I mean, now sometimes patients have temporary dialysis. If they go into renal failure because of shock, let's say, from massive hemorrhage, sometimes they have temporary dialysis until we can get the kidneys over the hump, kind of say. This is more from long-standing chronic disease like diabetes and hypertension. And some people have both, okay? So that's just why you want to keep your diabetics, their blood sugar, at as close to normal levels as possible. Keep their blood sugar consistently under 150 and your blood pressure under what? At least 150 over 90. But you got people walking around with high blood sugars and high, because sometimes these are two things you don't realize are wrong with you until things really start to go wrong. I took care of a woman one time who, she was like young, in her early 30s. She came into our ICU. She was in full-blown renal failure and they couldn't understand why. Well, it turned out she had long-standing hypertension that she had no idea she even had. She walked around with hypertension for years, like 200 over 100 blood pressure. For years, didn't realize she had it and it destroyed her kidneys. She came in full-blown renal failure, had to go on dialysis. Her kidneys were shot. Okay, and when it gets to that point, it's too late. If you got a glomerular filtration rate of 15, it's too late. Okay, so I mean, this is why you gotta know your blood pressure, know your blood sugar. It's important. How many of you guys know your blood pressure and your blood sugar? Okay, well, your nurse is now. Okay, now the dialysis catheter, if you know what can happen. This is the fun part of being a nurse, right? You know everything that can go wrong in your body. Okay, this is the hemodialysis machine, what it kind of looks like. It can wheel right into the room. They have portable ones that go right into the room at the bedside. Probably next semester when you're at the hospital, you'll see them because they do it right in the hospital. Patients, when they're home, they go to outpatient dialysis centers. But we can do it in the hospital too. But there are specialized training. And this is what the graft kind of looks like when it's implanted. It's not usually this far down. It's usually more up this antecubital area. And then the catheter one would be in the neck like this, but these are only temporary. And only the dialysis nurse accesses this catheter. We don't go messing around with IVs with this because we don't want it to get infected. Because, you know, us nurses, we can do that, right? So this is what it would look like. See how it has a venous and an arterial port? That's what the one in the neck, the temporary one, would look like. And this is what the graft would look like. But this piece here is under the skin. It's not going to be on top of the skin. It's almost going to look like a big snake under the skin, like a big tubing, or like a it's thick like that. Okay?
How long that can be there?
That can be in there for a long time. And you want it to last as long as possible. So when you have patients that have AV fistulas or an AV graft like this, what do you think to preserve the integrity of this? What do you think you don't want to do on that arm?
Blood pressure.
No blood pressures on that arm. What else?
Blood
lab work. No blood draws. You don't want to mess that up. You don't want that stuck for anything but dialysis. Okay, so we preserve these arms. No blood pressures, no blood work done in arms with AV grafts or AV fistulas, which is basically what that is. That's the graft. This is what the peritoneal looks like. You see how it's going to go in through the catheter? It looks almost like an IV bag. It looks almost like IV fluid, only specially meant for the dialysis, the peritoneal dialysis. And see how it goes in the peritoneum and it comes out looking like what? Urine. Isn't that amazing?
Can I ask you a question? Like, how does the patient feel when it's happening? Like, do they feel like they have a full?
I think they get used to it. Oh. And they only put like a liter in at a time. Or if they can't tolerate it, they'll put less in, but they'll probably have to have more cycles done.
Okay.
Like if they can only tolerate 500, it's not like getting an enema where you have to hold it in. It's not that significant. Now, organ transplantation. In New Jersey, everyone really should identify themselves. They would like everybody to identify themselves as an organ donor or not. Anybody who dies in the state of New Jersey, the sharing network has to be notified for the potential for organ or tissue donation. Again, it's the sharing network that approaches the family. We would just notify the sharing network of potential donors. Now, who would be potential donors? Somebody who's imminently going to die, right? We know we're in the hospital, we're taking care of somebody, we know they're going to die. Now, who do you think they're most interested in?
Young
individuals with good, healthy organs. We don't want the 90-year-old with organs that are 90 years old, right? But still, they look at corneas, all kinds of different tissues. So it could be anything. So it's not up to us to approach families. We just call the sharing network and let them know of potential donors. And then the sharing network makes contact with the family. But if it's we recently had in our ICU a young man who hung himself, unfortunately, a young man. But again, all the organs were fine. He was kept oxygenated and they brought, you know, all his organs were in good shape. So this was a potential organ donor situation. Again, not for us to approach the family, but the sharing network, experts in doing this, they approach the family and decide, the family decides whether or not they want to be involved with organ and tissue donation.
The sharing network, they have an office in the hospital?
No, you contact them by phone and they send a representative, okay? And again, they have to do compatible blood and tissue typing. So again, it takes a long time to even get a suitable donor for a person. But if you are a candidate for donation, they would have your tissue type and your blood and tissue type categorized already, so that when they find a suitable donor, they can notify you right away, so that they would take the organ and then you go to surgery like pretty much simultaneously, because they can only keep these organs oxygenated for a certain amount of time after death. But when they harvest organs, I know it sounds like a frightening thing, but they take the person to the operating room and remove the organs before they remove the person from the ventilator. You guys understand that. They want to keep these organs oxygenated, and once a person stops breathing, are the organs oxygenated anymore? No. Certain tissues you can still take from cadavers, from people who have already died, but hearts and things like that need to come from people that are still alive. So these decisions have been made by families, and the patient actually, they harvest the organs and then they would expire in the operating room after the organs are removed. But you have to look at it as keeping life going, right? If this person is no longer alive, no longer going to function, think of how many people will live because of those organs. Okay, and I'm not going to ask, but you know, you need to think about organ donation. I mean, I'm an organ donor, so it's something you have to think about. When you apply for a license now in New Jersey, they ask you. Jeannie is too, it looks like.
I told her my stepdaughter died, she was an organ donor. She died in the state, but she got a letter from the Gifts of Life of the final recipient list, and right away her bones and skin, shoulder bones, with the help of a young burn victim, her bone marrow went to like 17 different states, but the best one was her corneas gained sight back to a 34-year-old blind man.
And so she lives on in all these people. So I mean, that's the uplifting part of all this. Certainly it's sad to lose a life, but how many lives have been changed because of that? So it's just mind-boggling. Okay, so factors influencing urination, growth and development. We'll go through a couple more and then we'll take a break. So little kids can't effectively concentrate their urine. That's what's happening there. They can get nocturnal enuresis or bedwetting. You see that? Sometimes kids will outgrow that, and that can be a stress factor too. When kids are more stressed out, it can be a psychological thing as well. Older adult has problem with urination simply because their muscle control may not be as good. They may have more incontinence issues. The glomerular filtration rate's going to decline, so they're more prone to going into renal insufficiency. And you can get nocturia. What's nocturia? You're going at night. Now, normally we can sleep through the night and not get up to urinate, but it seems the older we get, the more times we have to get up to go to the bathroom at night. And I mean, working nights and putting people on the bedpan at night, I'm telling you, there are some, especially little old ladies, you're putting them on the bedpan every hour for like 10 cc's of urine, so 10 mls of urine. And the frequency, where you feel the urge to go a lot. And in men, the BPH, which can lead to urinary retention, which we're going to talk about. And residual urine, that's like when you empty your bladder, you don't empty your bladder all the way. Some urine stays behind, and it can be a medium for urinary tract infection. Sociocultural factors. Well, nobody likes to urinate in public, right? Or in a public bathroom where you're hearing other people urinating at the same time. It's almost creepy, right? But then when you go to Europe sometimes, it's not such an issue. I've even heard of like open toilet areas, communal toilets. So it's kind of an American thing where everything has to be real private, especially like bowel movements, right? That's even more of an issue. Some people, they can't have a bowel movement unless they're where? In their home, on their own home. So that's kind of like what we're saying with that. Psychological. Well, we know this, anxiety and stress, right? The first day at clinical, I used to always see my students lined up to go to the bathroom because stress increases that urge to go, right? And you need to relax, right? Sometimes you just need to relax to void. And what can you do to help somebody relax, to help with those muscles? What do you think you could do?
Run water.
That calming flow of the water. Sometimes just running some warm water over the thigh can do it too. To get that stimulus to go. Hearing the water run sometimes will do it. But you stand there. Your muscle tone, the weak muscles will lead to urinary incontinence, distress incontinence. And prolonged immobility, which we see with our patients sometimes, the stretching of the muscles, menopause can do it too, cause muscle atrophy, damage from trauma, or long-term catheter use can make that muscle weak. Now, Kegel exercises is a good way to increase muscle tone. You know, everybody knows Kegel exercises, you tighten up those pelvic floor muscles and release them. You can all do your Kegel exercises while you're sitting here, right, and not even know it, and be, you know, tightening up those pelvic floor muscles to prevent that future incontinence that lurks ahead, right? You want those leaky pipes, like the commercial says, the Besicare. You want to, you know, those pipes that are, like, dancing down the street. All right, fluids. Ingested, this makes sense. The more fluid you drink, the more circulating volume you're going to have, the more urine output you're going to have. Things that can increase urine formation, coffee, right? The more coffee we drink, what? The more times we go to the bathroom. Cola drinks too. But the other side of this is caffeine is a bladder stimulant. So the more caffeine you drink, the more chance you're going to have more urge or that feeling that I got to go. So it's a bladder irritant as well as a diuretic. So it can make you want to go more, but the irritation makes you feel like you have to go more. And as I said, alcohol inhibits the release of antidiuretic hormone, which results in increased water loss in the urine and dehydration. So the more you drink, the more dehydrated you are going to get. Surgery can do it. Isn't that interesting? Surgery. So anytime I go to surgery, that knife cuts my body, it's a stress. What did we say? We talked about this before. Stress ignites what? General adaptation syndrome. And the body is in a conservation mode. So the body thinks something bad's about to happen because your body's being cut. Surgery is anesthesia. It's a stressor to the body. So the body wants to conserve water, and that reduces urine output. So right after surgery sometimes, you'll see a decrease in urine output. So a lot of times after surgery, they'll really monitor a patient's urinary output. But you almost expect to see a drop in urine output because of starting the general adaptation syndrome. So if I'm seeing less than 240 mls, I might say, well, the body's kind of conserving water right now. It's an expectation, but I would still notify your physicians. It's still less than what we're going to say normal urinary output is, which is 30 mLs an hour. So for an 8-hour shift, if my patient only put out 100 mLs and they're a fresh post-op patient, I'm giving my doctor a call. He may want to increase the fluids temporarily. But usually within 24 hours, the urinary output picks back up again. But it's not an uncommon thing to see drop in urinary output after surgery. And you know why now. General adaptation syndrome does this. Okay? So the stress causes increased aldosterone, resulting in decreased urinary output.
What about parasympathetic? Is that part of that too?
What do you mean parasympathetic?
Yeah, and breaking everything.
Not decrease in urine output. No, doesn't have to do with that. This is more a mechanism of aldosterone. Okay, but it's good that you think about that. Anesthetics and narcotics, like the anesthesia that's given to put you to sleep, and usually you're going to see narcotics after surgery for pain control, right? They can also slow glomerular filtration rate, resulting again in decreased urinary output. So you can have a triple whammy almost. You have general adaptation syndrome, the anesthesia, and the narcotics decreasing glomerular filtration rate and having a resultant decrease in urinary output. So sometimes your doctors may say they want hourly urine outputs. Now they'd have to have a Foley catheter in to do hourly urine outputs. And there's a special catheter bag that has a little contraption that collects the urine every hour. I don't know if I have a picture of it or not, but it's called it's just a Foley bag that is set up to do hourly outputs. But of course, you'd have to have a catheter in order to do this, because you can't ask your patient to pee every hour for you.
But I don't think it empties itself.
No, you have to go in and empty yourself.
Yeah,
the nurse, usually these patients are gonna be in ICU or under closer monitoring. But yes, you have to go in and hourly dump it into the main bag.
Right, yeah.
And medications, of course, can do it, right? Diuretics. Some drugs cause urinary retention. What's urinary retention? You make the urine, but it's staying in the bladder. All right, antihistamines can do it. And certainly medications can. You have the medications that you see for bladder control issues, like Vesicare and Detrol. For people who have urge incontinence, there are medications that also affect urination. And then some medications will change the color of the urine. Pyridium turns your urine orange. So you can, sometimes that happens too. Okay, so we'll do this quicker question, then we'll take a break. A young girl is having problems urinating postoperatively, because we always have to look at our pediatric thing. You remember that children may have trouble voiding. So this is a growth and development type question here. All right, and in the presence of a person other than their parents, they might be more. You might want to give them some privacy, especially if it's a school age child. You might want to give them some privacy. Okay, so go ahead and take a break, and then we'll be back.